BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to this Moneybox podcast. An analysis of official data indicates that the number of households who'll struggle to buy enough food and keep warm this winter has grown to 2.5 million. National Savings cuts prices on premium bonds and reduces the interest paid on some deposit accounts. And people giving dodgy financial advice on social media are cautioned by the regulator. But how can you sort out the good from the dangerous? But first, there are just 4 sleeps before Rachel Reeves stands up in Parliament and ends 93 days of budget speculation. This morning brought what appeared to be a confirmed leak that the main tax rise would be in the national insurance contributions paid by employers, raising at least £20 billion a year. But that would fill only half the gap of £40 billion in her accounts, which she's identified. The rest must come from somewhere else. She's promised repeatedly not to increase taxes on what she and the Prime Minister call working people. So most thoughts have turned to inheritance tax, capital gains tax and the tax advantages of pensions. Some people, of course, have tried to preempt the budget. There's been a 16% increase in capital gains tax receipts in the last 3 months as people crystallise their gains under the existing rules. One pension provider has reported a tenfold increase in money going into pensions and reports twice as much being taken out in tax-free lump sums in case they're restricted in future. Our reporter, Joe Krasner, spoke to people in Liverpool city centre about what they're hoping or fearing on Wednesday.
I'd like for the tax threshold to be increased, taken up to at least £13,000 for a pensioner. Paying tax now, when the new increase is coming with the 4.1% rises we're getting on the pensions, how many pensioners will be taken into the tax bracket now? Invisible taxes that are going to be cast and thrust upon us.
So with the budget coming up, are you concerned at all what it might bring?
Well, yes, I'm concerned at the state of the public finances as have been inherited. So, as Rachel Reeves says, it's hard times ahead, I'm afraid.
Yeah, we've got to pay for it some way, haven't we? So are you making any changes in case you're adversely affected?
I'm going to fill it with petrol.
What about changes to inheritance tax or capital gains?
Well, capital gains doesn't affect us, but inheritance tax, I'm very interested. Yeah, because we're okay at the moment, but I would definitely start to make changes to provide for my children so that we don't pay inheritance tax.
Yeah, we just need to watch out so we don't get clobbered.
Well, listening to that is Tom Selby. He's Director of Public Policy at AJ Bell, the investment platform. Tom Selby, you and I have enjoyed many budgets over the years. Mm. I don't remember one so eagerly anticipated, do you?
Hi, Paul. It's been a lot. I think it's fair to say I think this is the most speculated upon budget that I can remember. We've had, I think it's the combination of 100 plus days since the general election, the grim fiscal backdrop, the fact that we've got a Chancellor who's boxed herself in with promises not to raise income tax, national insurance and VAT and not to increase taxes on working people. And I think as well, just the novelty of it being a Labour budget after 14 years of Conservative and coalition budgets means we've ended up with this 10-week guessing game about where the pain's going to be felt.
Yes, because previous budgets haven't actually made that many changes, have they? But this one, we all expect a lot of changes. Mm. We'll see if that happens, of course. Now, filling up your car with petrol, like that woman in Liverpool said, is, you know, probably not a bad thing, but it's no risk. But I mentioned people have been selling assets, paying in or taking out from pensions. What have your clients been doing?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of activity ahead of the budget. So we have seen increases in the number of people paying, increases in the value of contributions to pensions. We've also seen an increase in the number of people accessing their pensions. We've also seen more people selling down assets and buying up the same investments within ISAs to avoid capital gains tax. So a lot of activity based on fear and speculation, which is never ideal.
No, I was going to say, is it sensible to make major and often irreversible changes just on rumours?
Well, certainly not in relation to your pensions and accessing your tax-free cash, it's really not ideal if you're doing that, because there are negative consequences to it. In relation to capital gains tax, I think people are acting rationally, but it isn't ideal, because clearly if nothing changes and the rate doesn't go up, then you might find actually you've sold at exactly the wrong time.
Yes, absolutely. And when can we expect the changes to start? Is it the moment she sits down, or is it next April? When will they actually start?
So it's hard to say with certain changes. So, for example, capital gains tax, that there's probably an incentive for the Chancellor to give us a bit of a run-in before that change is brought in. So if there is an increase in the rate of capital gains tax, then actually deferring that until April next year, for example, would allow the Treasury to get a bit more money in the interim, because more people will look to sell their assets down ahead of that rate increase. So it is possible that we'll get certain changes overnight. The national insurance change, for example, I would expect to happen quite quickly so the government can get the money in, but other changes they're likely to consult on and take a bit more time over.
And inheritance tax, of course, normally depends on the date of death, doesn't it? So that will apply possibly to deaths from the 31st of October, if it changes.
Yes, it is possible that that would be brought in quite quickly, but clearly that would only affect future deaths, it goes without saying.
Yes, and frozen tax thresholds, which the chap in Liverpool mentioned, I mean, that's a big one, isn't it? No rise since 2021. The personal allowance should be more like £15,000 now. Do you think she's going to extend that for another couple of years?
It would be pretty painful if the Chancellor did, frankly, and it would slightly undermine the pledge not to increase taxes on working people, which has become a bit of a difficult phrase for this government. But just because you pledge not to raise the rate of income tax doesn't mean that people aren't going to be paying more income tax. That was already the case. And clearly, if you extend those frozen thresholds, then people's income tax bills are going to go up even more than they already have.
Yes. And are you any clearer now about what they mean by working people? Is it really money earned by working rather than the people themselves that they're protecting?
Yeah, they've got themselves in a bit of a pickle over this. It feels like what is a working person is in the eye of the beholder. I think Keir Starmer has tried to say that essentially it is he's focusing what he has on in his mind is the income that you earn from the work that you do day to day, rather than any income that you might get from shares, for example. But clearly there are people who have full-time jobs who also own shares who would see their taxes go up as a result of capital gains tax going up.
And are you expecting increases in the rates of capital gain tax? I mean, that's been widely trailed, hasn't it?
Widely trailed. It seems to be on the cards. I think the phrasing from the Chancellor and the Prime Minister around what is a working person suggests they wanted to leave the door open for rates to increase. But we'll obviously have to wait and see what we get in the budget on Wednesday.
And the Treasury told us, of course, it doesn't comment on speculation around tax changes outside of fiscal events. And this budget will certainly be that. Just in a word, 93 days after the announcement, are you still pretty excited about Wednesday?
I'm looking forward to having some actual information. It has been a fairly exhausting 100 plus days of rumour and speculation. So actually having that document there and saying, right, this is what we've actually got, this is what people have to deal with, it'll be a relief.
Indeed it will. Tom Selby of AJ Bell, thanks. And just a couple of hours after the budget, that's at 3 o'clock on Wednesday, Moneybox Live with Felicity Hannah will have a top team analysing what it all means for our money. Let us know if you've sold property, topped up your ISA, maybe given money away because you're worried about changes. Email us moneybox@bbc.co.uk, or you can send us a WhatsApp, a voice note on 03306 783 183. Now, those are Rachel Reeves' tough decisions, but figures seen by this programme suggest 2.5 million households will face their own tough decisions this winter, choosing whether to heat their home or put food on the table. That's an increase of 400,000 in just a few months. The numbers come from official data modelled by the consultancy firm Baringa, whose clients include energy suppliers, and they indicate many of those affected are middle-aged people struggling to get by. Dan Whitworth's been looking at the issue. Dan?
Well, Paul, this is all about people like Joanna from Colchester. She's a single mum of two who works full-time for the NHS. but whose £29,000 a year salary barely covers her priority bills, never mind having enough left over to go food shopping with and, quite frankly, everything else the family needs. Now, because things are so tight, she gets a top-up of around £450 each month from Universal Credit.
If I didn't have that top-up, I honestly have no idea how I would live. That's the God's honest truth. I wouldn't have money for heating or eating at that point. I have to make sure that I scrimp on what we eat. I choose to feed us in the house cheaper meals, which really, really isn't great for any of our health. We suffer from health conditions in this house, but we can't afford to have, I guess, a well-balanced diet, so it's cheap. I've not switched the heater on at the moment, and I don't intend to anytime soon because I cannot afford the cost of my energy.
Now, Joanna is typical of the way financial vulnerability is shifting through the age groups, according to this research from Baringa. For example, it suggests that vulnerability, which it describes as lacking the income to cover reasonable day-to-day expenditure, is actually most pronounced for 34 to 55-year-olds, with 30% of that age group affected. Whereas for people aged 65 and over, perhaps a more stereotypical group people might think would struggle in this way, well, this data suggests it's a much smaller 13% of them who are struggling. Here's Joanna again.
The last, I would say, 3 or 4 months, I'm actually using a credit card to get myself through the rest of the month. So I'm increasingly in more and more debt as the months go by. And it's worrying at the moment. I have no idea what I'll be this time next year, especially debt-wise. It's really stressful. Myself, I can say mentally, there are nights where I cry consistently. I feel, it sounds really silly at the moment, I feel like I don't have a voice because I claim universal credits. So that's it's taxpayers' money. And I feel worthless, I guess. I'm working full time. I should be able to support myself and my children on the wage that I'm on.
Joanna telling her story to Dan. Well, with me in the London studio is Jasmine Jenkinson from that consultancy firm, Baringa. Jasmine Jenkinson, heating or eating? How did your research conclude 2.5 million households would, as we've heard from Joanna, literally face this tough decision in the winter?
Yeah, absolutely. So within our research, we have modelled and we've looked at both income and then what are those essential outgoings for individuals like Joanna. So we're taking into account what they are spending on their bills, their food and their housing, and what that discretionary income looks like at the end of the month and a more holistic view. I think the stark thing within that.
So this is the money they have left after they've spent what they have to on heating and eating.
It absolutely is the money that is left post essential outgoings.
Right. And there are some people, I mean, as we heard from Joanna, she's actually got nothing left. She's borrowing to buy day-to-day essentials, which is not a good recipe for the future, is it? Who are the people who are most suffering from this in your research?
So within our research, we've seen a real shift in those financial vulnerability norms. Historically, we've always associated pensioners, for example, with having high levels of vulnerability. That has now shifted, so it's the age range of what we'd call middle-aged, and that's 35 to 45. And especially it's heightened for people in that age range that do have dependents, so children's or elderly relatives.
Well, especially living by yourself with two teenagers, as Joanna is, I mean, that must be the hardest of all. And these are big numbers, aren't they? 2.5 million people in very serious difficulty this winter. What do you think needs to happen?
I think there's a three-pronged approach, in all honesty. So I think we need to see the government, and especially as the budget announcement comes later next week, really focus on what forms of targeted support they can offer. I think secondly, we're looking towards the private sector, so our utility providers, to be more proactive and identify their customers sooner who are in need and support them through that. And then thirdly, that it's sort of back to the Joanna and the consumers of the world in terms of how do you educate yourself and be proactive in getting in touch and getting the support early.
Yes, I mean, the government did tell us, you know, it's got the £150 warm home discount for 3 million low-income and poorly insulated households. The winter fuel payment means-tested now, but that will still help 1.5 million pensioners. And there's this £500 million extension to the Household Support Fund, which we have talked about on the programme before. What is there that Joanna herself can do to help herself?
Absolutely. There's three things really that a consumer like Joanna could be doing at the moment to get help through this winter. First of all, I would urge you to be in touch with both your water and energy provider. They are obligated and they have lots of schemes to help you with struggling to pay. Secondly, use charities or grants. Turn to websites such as Turn to Us to help identify what you're applicable for. And then thirdly is look to that local council, back to that household support fund. It's now in place until April 2025. There's the opportunity to really get support with the cost of food and living.
Thanks, very good advice. So it's not just being on Universal Credit, it's there are many other sources of help too. Jasmine Jenkinson of Baringa, thanks very much for talking to us. National Savings and Investments announced cuts in the returns on some of its products this week. The premium bond interest rate has been cut and the odds of winning lengthened. From the December draw, National Savings says there'll be fewer winners and they'll share less money in prizes. Also, returns on its accounts called Direct Saver and Income Bonds are being cut by a quarter point from 4% to 3.75% from the 20th of November. Now, I know people love National Savings, but you know there are better deals out there. Here's Anna Bowes, co-founder of Savings Champion.
Activity in the savings market slowed considerably recently, and that's probably due to the fact that we're waiting for the results of the budget and the next base rate decision. But the good news is, in the meantime, there are still plenty of inflation-beating accounts if you take time to shop around. If you need immediate access to your money, there are also still accounts paying the high 4%, so 4.85, even one paying 5%. But, of course, these rates are variable. So if and when interest rates fall, so too will the interest you're earning on your variable rate savings accounts. So just bear that in mind. What is interesting is that the top 5-year bonds are paying less than the top 1-year bonds, which is unusual. Normally, you'd expect to be rewarded if you were to tie your money up for longer. But this indicates really that the markets are expecting interest rates to fall. So although, for example, the top 1-year bond is currently paying 5%, whilst the top 5-year bond is paying 4.4%, you might end up winning if you were to tie some of your money up for longer, because you'll earn those current rates for the duration, regardless of what happens to interest rates in the meantime.
Anna Bowes, and you can get all the up-to-date rates on savingschampion.co.uk. Who do people rely on for financial advice? Apart from Moneybox, of course. All too often, it's social media. But just this week, 20 so-called financial influencers on social media were interviewed under caution by the regulator over concerns they've been promoting products illegally. The Financial Conduct Authority says it's part of targeted action on social media personalities who give money advice but aren't qualified or regulated and may be promoting financial products that are scams. Regulators also issued 38 alerts against social media accounts that may contain unlawful promotions. Our reporter Emma Smith has been looking at some posts on social media this week. Emma, what kind of things did you find?
Well, Paul, there are a lot of videos and posts available across many platforms, everything from Facebook to TikTok and Instagram. I found lots of videos that could actually be really helpful. Tips on how to budget, what is an ISA, as well as saving trends like the hashtag no spend challenge. However, there are some videos online which claim they can make you very rich if you invest your money into a product or a new digital currency. This is the kind of content that the FCA are looking at. I went to speak to some young people in Manchester.
So, whereabouts do you go for your financial advice?
To my sister or to my parents.
To be honest, I just get it online.
Literally just my parents, honestly.
I'd probably just Google it. Google. I'd just see whatever the first couple of things we come up with.
TikTok.
TikTok.
I get my financial advice from my parents, I guess.
Parents. Yeah. So Mama knows everything, you know?
Mama knows best.
I go to my parents.
Your parents. Would you ever go online for that advice?
Nah.
No. Wouldn't use social media or anything?
No. I feel like social media is like a bit scammy nowadays.
It'd be like, oh, like you've got to grind, you've got to hustle. Like that's what Instagram financial advice is.
Maybe for like general budgeting, but if it was like a specific thing, then no.
Yeah, I usually just trust my parents with that kind of information.
Yeah.
For me, it's more like for entertainment. I wouldn't look at it for like real life advice.
So, parents versus social media. And Emma, did you ask the firms behind these platforms how they deal with bad, even illegal, financial advice on them?
Yes, I spoke to TikTok, which said it wants its users to learn about ways to be financially responsible without worrying about scams or financial exploitation. And it does not allow attempts to defraud or scam members on it in its community. I did ask Meta, which owns Instagram. It didn't respond, but it's told Moneybox before that it doesn't allow people to deceive others through investment or financial scams. It also said that it requires posts advertising financial services, which target people in the UK, to be authorised by the FCA.
Thanks, Emma. Well, listening to that is Natalie Holt. She's a content editor at the financial consultancy The Lang Cat. Natalie Holt, how big a problem is poor, even dangerous advice on social media?
Hi, Paul. Thanks. So I think there is a big problem here, actually. I mean, the FCA has said that increasing numbers of young people are falling victim to scams, and they think that these kind of financial influencers can play a part in that. And there's also been quite a significant increase in these influencers over recent years. So I think that's why the regulator is acting now.
Right. So it's been going on for a while, but it is actually getting worse rather than better. I mean, many of those people in Manchester that Emma talked to did seem very aware they should be cautious. And it was sweet how many relied on their parents. My mum knows everything, one of them said. But some sites do post warnings, don't they, that people should do their own research. And that presumably is good advice.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's probably important to say there are good influencers out there, and I'd probably count yourself among those, Paul. And then there are kind of bad ones as well. So people who are not giving reliable information or information that's misleading. And I think that's the area where people should be looking for red flags, I think.
Yes. And of course, there are some regulated and authorised advisors, aren't there, for mortgages and even investments. They can be trusted, presumably.
Yeah, so I think there are good people who are doing good things. And I think the things to probably watch for are, is the person who's kind of promoting this thing trying to sell to you, or are they trying to give you information? I think that's quite an important distinction. And also, if there's a sense of urgency about it, then I think that's one to steer clear of as well.
Yes, and also be aware that some people, so-called influencers, are actually only influencers because they're actually paid to promote things. They don't know much about them or even believe in them, perhaps, but because they're getting money, they don't care. How do you sort them out?
Yeah, well, I think if you're coming across perhaps celebrities, maybe they're footballers or reality TV stars or whoever it happens to be, I think you kind of need to just question, are they really kind of acting within their own kind of area of expertise? So I think some of the things that they promote that you can see online is often quite high risk. It's often quite complicated. So it's kind of a get back to basics, really, of do you actually understand the thing that you're investing in? And if you don't, then best to kind of avoid it, I think.
Yes. I mean, I always say it's, if you're on social media, it's like being in a cafe and somebody comes up to you and says, oh, I can make you a lot of money. I mean, would you believe them then? But people believe them on social media. It almost carries a credibility with it, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think people are quite good at spotting things like, you know, phishing scams or emails and texts. I think we're quite used to that. But in different environments, I think people kind of maybe drop their guard, and it's good to kind of challenge and question and be suspicious, I think, of what you're hearing in that context as well. And that kind of extends to chat rooms as well as places like YouTube and explicit promotions, I think.
Yes. And where can you check people out? I mean, if somebody is claiming to be a proper financial advisor or a mortgage advisor or whatever, how can you check them out?
Yes. So I think you need to look at whether the person giving you this information, are they regulated to give financial advice, first of all, and are they authorised by the FCA? You can use the Financial Services Register to do that. Yep. And I think also it's important to look at the investment and company that you're dealing with. Are they protected under the Financial Services Compensation Scheme?
That's very good advice, Natalie Holt from the Lang Cat. Thank you. And of course, for reliable financial information and advice,
what you must do is tune to Moneybox.
Even better than asking your mum. Well, it's Rachel Reeves' big day on Wednesday, and in next week's podcast, we'll at last be able to sweep away those clouds of speculation and reveal the truth in all its glory, or indeed horror. You can email us with your financial fears and hopes, budget or otherwise, moneybox@bbc.co.uk, or why not send us a message, or better still, a voice note, which we love, on WhatsApp, 03306 783 183. That's 03306 783183. In this podcast, the team were Dan Whitworth, Emma Smith and Joe Krasner, studio manager Lucy Harper. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Paul Lewis, and this was a BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Danny. It's been too long, but I am back and I wanted to let you know about something very special that is going to be happening on the Uncanny podcast feed this October. As we all know, this is the month of Halloween, that most ghostly time of year. And to celebrate, I am going to be doing a Halloween advent calendar. Every single day during October, I will be dropping a brand new mini case into the Uncanny feed. Each one under 2 minutes long, a tiny bite-sized nugget of terror, an email from a listener recounting an experience they believe may have been paranormal. But is it? There will also be video versions of the stories on all of my social media channels. The episodes will land every single morning, 31 stories in all, leading all the way up to Halloween. And there might just be some special Halloween surprises to come too. So that is the Uncanny Halloween Advent Calendar on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. Join me if you dare.